All right, welcome in, everybody. We're great. It's great to have you listen to the program today. It's Backpatting Day. Reach around, pat yourself on the back, unless you dislocate your shoulder in the process, and congratulate yourself because you made it to Friday. This is Tony Bean, Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference. My co-host is Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian, this is Hannah Miller, informed and unafraid.
Did you say it was Breitbart that had the story about the doctor?
Blaze.
Okay. Blaze Media, right? Or just...
Just TheBlaze.com.
TheBlaze.com.
And it's over on the right. You know, they have the...
Most
the
recent.
Very,
okay.
Very
Independence
top
Day
one.
Parade. Ex-NFL player suspected of murder.
That's
of
it.
Doctor. Yeah, there it is. Okay. I couldn't find it. I was looking everywhere because I want to talk about that at some point. We've got a couple of interviews coming your way today. We're going to have Senator Lindsey Graham. We'll play that interview... Maybe we'll do it at 7:30, right after the break at the bottom of the hour. And then we've got an interview with Senator, so two senators, one state senator, one federal senator or Washington senator, Senator Graham at 7:30, Senator Josh Kimbrell at 8:05. And he'll give us a little bit of an update and a recap on what happened in the legislature this week. I want to start out today talking about the Derek Chauvin trial. And the reason I want to talk about it is because unless you're watching the trial, if you're listening just to the reporting about the trial, you probably think that this is a slam dunk when it comes to Derek Chauvin going to jail. I mean, that was, I got to be honest, that was me, you know, because even Fox News, even other sources, what you hear happening is the prosecution putting on their case. Now, the defense hasn't even gotten up to bat yet.
Yeah.
But, and of course, when you hear one side of the story, then you're going to look at the evidence that the prosecution is presenting. And if they've got any case at all, you're going to say, wow, this guy is guilty as sin. And especially if you don't hear the defense's cross-examination of the prosecution's witness. And as far as I've been able to determine, there's very little discussion across the scope of all media about the cross-examinations. Now, there's mitigating factors about the cross-examination. I mean, you have to understand, the jury is sitting in the courtroom, and they're hearing a broad spectrum of evidence. We're getting bits and pieces of evidence that fits a narrative that says that police are murderers when it comes to black people, and that we have systemic racism, and that if George Floyd isn't convicted, if Derek Chauvin isn't convicted of murdering George Floyd, then cities ought to burn and there should be rioting in the streets. I'm going to look during the break. I just didn't get around to it before the show started this morning to tell you there was somebody in media who actually said that. Somebody was being interviewed, and they said, well, if we don't get a guilty verdict for Derek Chauvin, this is what we're going to do.
I watched a video about that as well, where and it was a woman. I don't know if it was the same person, but this woman was saying,
it was a woman.
Yeah, she was saying that very thing. Like, look, if we don't get what we want and what we think is justice, we're just going to burn everything down. But that's what we said last year. We said, look, this is going to be a lose-lose for Minneapolis, unfortunately.
It is, and it's going to be a win-win for activists.
Yeah.
If
and the media. Because that's what they want. I mean, they want this kind
of
thing, which is why
a lot of people.
Which is why a lot of them in the mainstream are, you know, they pick and choose what they tell people that is going on at the trials in order to convince people that this is a slam dunk guilty verdict for Derek Chauvin. And then when it doesn't come through, they think the whole system is broken.
Right.
Because
so they're going to win if Chauvin is convicted. Then they're going to be able to go out and say, see, we told you that there's systemic racism, and here's the evidence is because Chauvin has been found guilty. They've looked at all the evidence, and this proves systemic racism. It doesn't, because to date, there still has not been one scrap, iota, drop, whatever descriptive phrase you want to use, of evidence to suggest that Derek Chauvin was a racist or that he did anything that he did that day because of racism. And this is the prosecution. Remember, if they were going to raise that, that's when you would hear it. And there's been none of that. So even if Chauvin is convicted, what it looks like is what we've talked about earlier, that the jury was convicted, was convinced that you had a police officer who was just out of control in this situation. In other words, he went too far with use of force. And so they decide that his actions contributed to George Floyd's death, and they find him guilty of something. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to be because of racism, but that's not what you're going to hear. If he's innocent, if they find him innocent, reasonable doubt, then you're going to have just chaos based on the fact that, well, we told you that everybody's a racist, and this proves it. Because we can't even, with the video of a police officer with his knee on the neck of George Floyd, we can't convict that police officer because of racism. So it really is for those who want the narrative of systemic racism in police and that within the police departments in the country, and that America as a whole is we're all a bunch of white supremacists. That narrative is going to prevail regardless of what happens at the trial. But the truth is that a lot of witnesses for the prosecution have actually faltered under questioning from the defense. It is not clear cut at all what happened. Prosecution called a witness the other day who was so bad that the prosecutor was angry at the witness. I mean, berated their own witness. It was a use of force expert. And this is where the prosecutor had to, they had a recess, and the prosecutor had to kind of go back and help the witness to better remember what he thinks happened. I mean, who does that? A medical support expert called by the prosecution was so bad the defense is going to call her and when it comes their time to present a defense of Chauvin. So that... How does that tell you that things are not going well? If you're a prosecutor and one of your witnesses, the defense says, excuse me, we'd like some information on her, please, because we believe she can help our case. And she's supposed to be one of the ones that's putting the nail in Chauvin's coffin, and it turns out she's gonna be called by the defense because of what she said under prosecution questioning. That's not good for the prosecution's case. So things like this are happening. Now, Derek Floyd, Derek Chauvin, excuse me, I get these names all, and I apologize. Derek Chauvin is charged with second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and third-degree manslaughter. The prosecution has to show causation to convict Chauvin of any of those charges. You've got an autopsy report that shows that Floyd had fentanyl and methamphetamine in his system. And that he had three times the amount that would kill him.
I think it was enough to kill a horse. Is that what they said?
Enough to kill a horse. Yeah, they've used that phrase. But the main thing to think about and to focus on is that he had three times the amount of drugs in his system that would normally kill someone. Now, he's a big guy. Very mm-hmm. muscular, tall, you know. So there are people making the argument that he could tolerate that, and because of his past drug use, he had built up a resistance to fentanyl. That may be true, but nobody builds up a resistance to three times the amount that would kill you. I mean, that's a whole lot of drugs in your system. The original medical autopsy, and this is just stuff that's come out this week. I'm kind of doing this as a recap before we move into next week. The original medical autopsy found that Chauvin's neck hold didn't do any damage to Floyd's trachea. Now, that's important because you would think that if asphyxiation was caused by the knee of Chauvin, then the trachea would be crushed.
Right. If he'd had enough pressure on the neck to, you know, obstruct his breathing, then it would have damaged the trachea.
So that suggests that whatever caused George Floyd to die of asphyxia, it wasn't Chauvin's knee. Maybe there was something else, but from the knee. Maybe it caused his blood pressure to spike, or maybe now that's all of that's still possible. Mm-hmm. It still could be that Chauvin's knee was the cause, but at least from the autopsy, the trachea not being crushed or being damaged is evidence that suggests reasonable doubt that it was Chauvin's knee that caused Floyd's death. By the way, let me just reiterate, I have never said, and I'm not saying now, that Chauvin is innocent, that he's completely without culpability in this thing. I don't know. But the point is, neither do you. Neither does anybody.
That's right.
Because all the evidence is being presented right now at the trial.
And people certainly didn't know, 4 hours after it happened.
Right.
Which is what everybody just jumped in.
Immediately
had
racism.
Racism,
murder.
Number one. Wow, what a horrible racist. And as you said earlier in the last segment, there still has not been a single shred of evidence that
nothing.
This guy had a
not
racial
any.
Animus.
Yeah.
It may come out that he is guilty of, some other things that were happening. He might have been neglectful, dereliction of duty, or whatever they may find. But it was not racism.
It's not going to be racism's not even an issue in the trial. Isn't that
that's right?
Does that just stop and think for a second? We went through a summer of burning buildings. Minneapolis suffered millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in damage to personal property and people's businesses. And in other places around the country, the same thing happened because all of this turned on racism. We're going into the second or third week of the trial next week, and not one shred of evidence has been presented that racism was any part of this. That was all a narrative that was generated by Black Lives Matter and then backed up by many voices in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And so we just need to remember that. Now, there's in order for Chauvin to be convicted, you have to prove causation. In other words, you've got to prove that the actions of Derek Chauvin caused George Floyd's death. And there's two kinds of causation. And I was fascinated when I learned about this because I did not know. Causation in fact and but-for causation. But-for causation says that in a chain of events, but for one of those events happening, George Floyd would still be alive. So let's give an example. Let's say George Floyd didn't get out of bed that day. He decided to stay in bed all day. Well, but for that, he would still be alive. In other words, he might have died of a drug overdose in his bed, but he surely wouldn't have been interacting with police that day. Let's say that George Floyd was the car he was riding in, comes up to a traffic signal, and it turns yellow, and instead of stopping, they go through the yellow light and keep going. The timing of all of this would have been off. And so maybe if that had happened, then that would have changed the outcome of the situation. The factual causation is a little bit different. There are a lot of intervening factors in the case. The jury is going to be asked to decide, does the factual evidence lean more toward George Floyd dying because of a drug overdose and his medical condition, or does it lean more toward George Floyd dying because of Derek Chauvin's knee or any action that Chauvin performed or should have or didn't perform and should have? Mm-hmm. That's essentially what the jury's got to decide. So Floyd's drug use and medical condition are relevant because the defense is saying that's their whole case, that was the causation of his death. Now, Courtney Ross, I don't know if you've heard that name, but that's Floyd's girlfriend, and she testified that just a few months ago that he overdosed and she had to take him to the ER. So we already know, you may say, well, George Floyd's past has no bearing on this. It shouldn't. All that is just smearing George Floyd. That shouldn't even come up at trial. No. If the defense is that he overdosed, then it matters to the jury, and it should matter to you, if that's what the defense is claiming, that he had a history of overdosing, right?
Right, that's right. Because one of the arguments that a lot of folks made, especially last year, right after this happened, was, when they brought up the things that, he had broken into somebody's home and he held a gun to a pregnant woman's belly and, all of these. And they're like, well, that was way in the past. He was a different man now. Everybody said he was a different man now. And none of that matters. But then all of a sudden we find out, oh, just a couple months ago, this, you know, the overdose. So he still has a current issue and a current history. This wasn't something that happened 20 years ago.
Now, it's also a fact that he was high at the time he was arrested. I bet you haven't heard much about this. It's likely his drug dealer was in the car with him. In fact, his drug dealer's name is Maurice Hall. Maurice Hall is currently in jail. Now, the defense wants Maurice Hall to testify because Maurice Hall was in close proximity to George Floyd before he died. There's a lot of things Maurice Hall could say that would add to the causation being an overdose of methamphetamine and fentanyl. I mean, but Maurice Hall won't testify.
He's pleading the fifth.
And the prosecution are the only ones that could grant him immunity. The prosecution don't want him anywhere near the courtroom, so they're not going to give him immunity, and he's not going to testify for the defense. If they make him testify, he's just going to plead the fifth. Because imagine this, Maurice Hall shows up, and under cross-examination, the defense lawyers ask, how many drugs did you give George Floyd that day? Mm-hmm. And if he testifies, you know, a lot, three times the amount that would be needed to kill him, then Maurice Hall is going to be on the chopping block. Mm-hmm. Maurice Hall is going to, they're going to immediately say, then you're the one that caused George Floyd's death, mm-hmm. not Derek Chauvin. Because all of this happened before Chauvin had any type of interaction with him. So we should ask the question, why is the prosecution preventing Maurice Hall from testifying? Well, because the prosecution's job is to prove their case. Maurice Hall is not going to help them to do that, so they don't want him near the courtroom. That's very simple. So Courtney Ross's Floyd's girlfriend, Courtney Ross, testified that Maurice Hall was selling drugs to Floyd. In fact, she told the FBI that from March to May, she admitted that they were buying drugs from this drug dealer. So 6 months after the incident, now, and this is interesting, I haven't heard this. 6 months after this, all of this happened with George Floyd, investigators for the defense went back to the squad car where, you remember, they got him in the car for a little while. They found half-chewed pills on the floor of the squad car, which was locked up for evidence. In other words, it wasn't back in service. They weren't going to use it because at some point there could be evidence in the trial. So the defense got a chance. When their investigators went through the car, they find these half-chewed pills on the floor, and they've got George Floyd's DNA on them. That's in the squad car where they were holding, where they got him in the car briefly before all of this went down where they had to restrain him. So don't you think that's relevant? How did the police investigating miss that in the beginning of all this? Why did it take 6 months for investigators for the defense to go back and find this evidence in the squad car? I think that's a valid question. Mm-hmm. Not saying Derek Chauvin is innocent. I'm saying that raises reasonable doubt. That goes to causation being drug overdose and George Floyd. I mean, he was in the car with a drug dealer. His girlfriend has testified that they were buying drugs from the guy that was in the car with him. He was high. He had drug overdosed and had to be taken to the ER just a couple of months before this incident happened. What does that sound like to you? And this is not even the defense putting on their case. This is the defense drawing this information out from witnesses that have been put on the stand by the prosecution. Which, I mean, if you're in that courtroom, to me, that's a lot of reasonable doubt. What about the 8 minutes and 46 seconds of tape that we're supposed to watch? That's what we're supposed to watch. Just that. Just the tape that was from a particular angle where Derek Chauvin's knee is on George Floyd's neck. Okay, that's what. But in the tape leading up to that 8 minutes, you hear George Floyd screaming that he can't breathe before he gets out of the car. In other words, before he ever got out of the Mercedes that he was in, when they stopped him, he was telling them that he couldn't breathe. Mm-hmm. So his suffering, was it due to him not being able to breathe? Was, if he was saying that before Derek Chauvin put his knee anywhere near George Floyd's neck, then you would have to reasonably assume that his breathing problems were not initiated. In other words, they didn't start with Derek Chauvin. They might have been exacerbated, but they didn't start with it because he was claiming that before he ever got out of the car. The defense lawyers brought out body cam footage, and I've seen it. I looked at it this morning. And did you know this existed? That one of the police officers that was on the scene, their body cam shows a different angle. And it's clear from that footage that Derek Chauvin's knee is on George Floyd's shoulder blade. That it's about right there above the clavicle. It's not on his neck, which is what the angle from the camera that we've seen. Mm-hmm. It looks like his knee is on Floyd's neck the whole time. Now, under cross-examination, Madario Arredondo, who is the Minneapolis police chief, he admitted under cross-examination when he looked at that video footage from the body cam that it appeared that Derek Chauvin's knee was on Floyd's shoulder and not on his neck. Now, when the prosecution came back up, they redirected and Arredondo said for the most of the time it looked to him like that Chauvin's knee was on Floyd's neck, but there were times in the video when it looked like his knee was on the shoulder. And really what the defense did was brilliant. They showed a side by side. They showed the video that everybody's seen for months, and they showed the body cam video at the same time. And it does look like Chauvin's knee is on Floyd's neck in the video that we've seen over and over and over. But if you look at the body cam footage, it's clear because you can't really see the knee. What you see in the footage that we've seen over and over is Chauvin kneeling over Floyd, and you see his leg in a position that looks like his knee is on the neck, but the body cam shows that his knee is on the shoulder. And so, for how long? Well, according to the police chief, he says that was toward the end and that Chauvin had his knee on the neck for most of the time, but toward right before EMS got there, like the last 3 minutes, he moved it to the shoulder. But, okay, be that as it may, is this the first time that you've even heard that there was body cam footage that suggested that Chauvin's knee was anywhere other than on George Floyd's neck? And here's the thing. This narrative that for 8 minutes and whatever, I mean, you know, you hear the exact timing, and I've heard 8 minutes and something. I've heard 9 minutes. I've heard 13 minutes. Whatever length of time, it's always been that Derek Chauvin's knee was on George Floyd's neck.
And it never moved.
And right. But that's not true. We know that at least for some period, his knee was on George Floyd's shoulder, not his neck. All right, ER physician, because we need to talk about him for a second, Bradford Langdonfeld. After he testified for the prosecution that George Floyd died from asphyxia, I mean, that was the – did you see that headline?
Right.
I mean, it was everywhere. George Floyd dies from asphyxia. Under cross-examination by the defense, he admitted that either one – or a combination of the drugs in Floyd's system could have caused his asphyxia. Now, that wasn't in most of the stories that I saw. Mm-hmm. But methamphetamines or fentanyl alone can, if you've got a heart condition, which George Floyd had a 70% blockage. He was he had heart issues. The combination of one of those drugs or the combination of the two could have caused him to die from asphyxia. Now, we've already talked about the fact that we heard testimony that Floyd was shouting, "I ate too many drugs." Well, this is where this officer that admitted that that's what it sounded like when he listened to the tape that Floyd was saying. And then after the recess, he comes back because he's a prosecution witness.
Right. The prosecution had to take him out and be like, dude, you can't say that.
So what he came back and said, he said, well, it sounds to me maybe like he was saying, I ain't do no drugs. Mm-hmm. So which is it? Now, the jury, that's one of the things the jury's going to have to decide. It's what they think they heard. But that's in question. I mean, that's reasonable doubt being presented in the case. Minneapolis use of force trainer Johnny Mercer testified that the use of force was not approved and it was inappropriate that Derek Chauvin used. But under cross-examination, Mercer admitted that he had personally he personally said that it had been used before. And that he contradicted himself completely.
That was one of the first questions that I had when all of this was kind of happening, was, is this something that's either in the manuals, which kind of became pretty quick, apparent pretty quick that this isn't really a part of training, like official police training.
Right.
But then my question was, okay, maybe it's not a part of official police training, but is it something that the police officers do or use frequently that, you know, others may be using that they need to address? And there was no answer for that. And so, but now there is.
Now it appears that they were mm-hmm. told to use this procedure. That if you had an aggressive, in fact, there's mm-hmm. one procedure that's higher than this. So mm-hmm. that's another issue. If Chauvin really was intending to kill Floyd, there was another procedure he could have used that would have been closer to being lethal.
I saw somebody yesterday ask too if his purpose or goal was to hurt, Floyd. Why didn't he tase him?
Right.
You know, as well. I mean, there was other things that he could have done that would have been more, even more aggressive.
Right.
But he didn't do.
Well, he asked and here's the thing. There's a big question about why didn't Chauvin give George Floyd, try to resuscitate him? Why didn't he perform CPR? And the defense contention is that the crowd had become aggressive, that they were so aggressive that the officers were distracted. They began to look at and think about how to react to the crowd because of the situation that was mm-hmm. developing. And so then EMS shows up. So you would think that if CPR was indicated, that EMS would begin CPR on the scene. Mm-hmm. But under cross-examination, what we find out is the reason EMS did what's called a load and scoot. In other words, they put Floyd on the gurney, lifted him, put him in the ambulance, and took off.
Right.
And the prosecution says, well, that's because he was in such bad shape that they were mm-hmm. trying to get him to the hospital to save his life. But under cross-examination, the prosecution's own witness admitted that the reason EMS behaved that way is they were afraid of the crowd. The crowd situation by that time had gotten so bad that they were not willing to pause long enough to perform CPR.
Which brings up to mind me, and again, I would clarify, like we still have to hear the other side of things. We still need more information on all of this. There still could be an argument made yeah. that Chauvin is guilty of
well,
something
and
hurting,
been.
And he has been of hurting George Floyd in some way. But you know, this raises to my mind too, if the crowd is getting that out of hand, and we now have proof that, you know, he didn't keep his knee on his neck for the whole 9 minutes and 29 seconds, which is what everybody was running around saying, then his knee is moving around. He's trying to figure out the crowd. There's a lot going on. He's feeling like things are escalating out of control. He may not be paying attention to exactly where his knee is at on George Floyd's body as he's holding this guy down
right.
and trying to figure out how to keep control of the situation.
Right.
Because you have to realize he's got, you know, how many people out here in the crowd that they've got to try to control and keep back, and this man on the ground who's already been fighting them and
right.
been aggressive.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just, again, a question that I'm having to ask myself. How would I handle that situation? How would you know?
Exactly. And that's what the jury's got to decide.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the main thing I want you to walk away with this morning. What you're hearing, if you're only in a tertiary way listening to this information mm-hmm. coming out from the trial, what you're hearing is that the prosecution is nailing Chauvin to the wall, that this is a slam dunk. That is not true. Because under cross-examination, the defense has at least raised reasonable doubt about the causation of Derek Floyd's death. They've raised reasonable doubt about the position of Chauvin's knee. They've raised reasonable. I mean, their whole defense is that he died of excited delirium, or that his asphyxiation was caused by the drug overdose. They're showing evidence that that's true. reasonable doubt. So this case is not a slam dunk. The jury may believe the prosecution's case, but they could believe the defense's case because they haven't even put on their case yet, and they poked a lot of holes in the prosecution's contentions. Just keep that in mind. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us today for Christian Worldview with Tony and Hannah. We are very excited to have as a guest today Senator Lindsey Graham. Senator, welcome to the program today.
Well, thank you. I hope you had a good Easter, and it's good to be home.
Yes, sir. Well, we did. I hope you did as well. I have five things I want to throw at you real quick and get your response. And the first one is H1. We've talked about that extensively on the program, what that would do to voting rights, federalizing the election system in this country, nullifying voter ID from sea to shining sea. I think it's a pretty bad idea, and I think you probably agree.
Yeah, okay. Terrible idea. What's number two? No, I'm telling you, it didn't take long to figure that one out, did it?
No.
So it's a power grab. So here's what's important. The reason they're attacking Georgia voting laws is to set up the narrative that you have to pass H.R. 1 because Georgia and Texas and other states are suppressing minority votes. So you got to change the filibuster so we can pass H.R. 1. That's all a bunch of BS. It makes no sense. In Georgia, you got 17 days to vote. You have to have a voter ID. Well, you have to have an ID to do most things in life nowadays. So the bottom line for me is the biggest power grab in modern American history. As you described, they do away with the voter ID requirement, trumping state law. They ballot harvesting becomes the law of the land, which is a disaster. Mail-in voting becomes the way to vote, where you get a ballot where you ask for it or not. What could possibly go wrong with that? You got publicly financed elections. For every dollar you raise, low dollars, you get $6. Can you imagine Jamie Harrison would add $1 billion if it had applied? So it just goes on and on. And the big one is redistricting. Every year, every 2 years, 4 years, I can't remember the number, but we redistrict for the House of Representatives. I think maybe it's 10 years. Bottom line is people are moving from California to New York to these red states. And Texas and Florida and South Carolina, we picked up a seat. They want to take redistricting away from state government and create a federal commission, which will be a disaster for us. So it's just the worst idea possible. We have to fight it. Hopefully Manchin will hold strong in Sinema, and we won't overturn the filibuster, and we can stop it from becoming law.
Let's go ahead, since you mentioned the filibuster, and take up that subject next. That's something that we're all very concerned about here in South Carolina. Are we going to be able to hold the filibuster until we can get to the midterms and change the makeup of the Congress?
Yeah, I think so. So here's the truth. When we had the House, the Senate, and the White House, in the first 2 years of the Trump presidency, there was enormous pressure on me and others to change the filibuster to pass all the things that you and I would love to pass. I said no. I said, listen, the Senate's been a place to slow things down, things you like and things you don't like, serve the country well to make sure you don't have wild swings in law. President Trump was pushing to change the filibuster, but we held the line. We had 61 senators sign a letter to Mitch McConnell and Schumer saying, keep the filibuster. 27 Democrats, just about every Democrat is flip-flopped. And, you know, it's very discouraging, but here's what I think. I think Joe Manchin from West Virginia took Robert Byrd's seat, is not going to agree to make the Senate the House. If the filibuster did get changed, D.C. would be a state. They would pack the Supreme Court. H.R. 1 would become law. It'd be a parade of horribles. But there'll come a time when we'll get the House, the Senate, and the White House back, and I'm going to say the same thing I'm saying here today. A 60-vote requirement on major legislation is good for the country. I think it's going to hold, and here's the problem. If we lose ground in 2022, God help us all, because if they had one more seat and they didn't need Manchin, we'd be in trouble.
Yes, that's absolutely true. It's very... Unfortunate what happened down in Georgia with those two Senate seats. We should have won those seats. We don't need to relitigate that or go over that ground again. Yeah. But that was just a huge missed opportunity that we cannot afford to have going forward. Let me ask you about the Equality Act, because obviously a lot of people in the Christian community here are concerned about this. This would put pressure on everybody who believes in absolute truth as is shared in the Word of God to conform to ideas and thoughts that go directly against their deeply held religious beliefs. Where do we stand on that, or is that something that we're going to be able to push back?
Well, you know, it comes back to getting 60 votes. I don't think there's any support by Republicans. You know, this is not about civil rights for gay people. This is not about making sure a person can eat in a restaurant and, you know, stay in a hotel. This is about transforming the definition of a man and woman.
Right.
The Equality Act, it specifically prohibits the Religious Restoration, Religious Freedom Act from being a defense. It's the only law that I know that excludes the religious freedom defense. So, like Bob Jones, for instance, you know, they can say no to a faculty member unless the faculty member is a Christian that follows the doctrine of the school, because it's a religious school, right?
Right.
Well, here's the problem. It's going to lead to, I think, institutionalizing biological males playing girls' sports, which will destroy women athletics. It will put, I think, over time, it's going to erode religious people's ability to, you know, run universities and conduct their life according with the tenets of their religion.
Yes.
It is a real threat, and it is a power grab, just like H.R. 1 being pushed by the most liberal people in the country. There's nothing uniting about the Biden presidency. I've known Joe Biden for 25 years. I'm just really shocked at how liberal his administration has become and how emboldened they are in the House. They have a very slim majority. But because of redistricting in 2022, I think we're a really good bet to take back the House. We need one more Senate seat. If we had won one of those Senate seats in Georgia, I would be chairman of the Budget Committee, not Bernie Sanders.
That's right.
So we got to vote in 2022 like our life depends on it, because it does.
You know, it's interesting about President Biden. He pretty much admitted during the campaign at one point that he was sort of going to be the placeholder, the safe bet for president. And now, you know, moderate Joe. President Biden has turned into one of the most left-wing progressive presidents since Woodrow Wilson. Do you get the feeling that his administration is being driven by forces that are outside the administration but are driving them to be so progressive?
Well, that's a good question. I know that Nancy Pelosi looks over her shoulder every day regarding AOC. See, if she violates the squad's agenda, Nancy Pelosi, she could lose her speakership. Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the Senate, is worried about AOC running against him in a primary in 2022. So all these people are under a lot of pressure from the radical left. But here's what I think. I think people around Biden have made a decision to try to make the Biden administration the most progressive since Wilson and FDR,
right,
to outshine Obama. I think there's been a rivalry there between Obama and the Biden camps for a long time, and they're going all in with spending and Medicare for all, the full money of liberal wish list. And it's been sad, and we just got to fight back. And I'm spending most of my day up there now trying to block the biggest change in American life and culture, certainly in my lifetime. And I need your prayers and support. But if we can pick up one more seat in the Senate, take back the House, we can shut all this down.
You know, I was listening to several podcasts yesterday, and we've talked about this on the show here, that overreach by progressives are driving voters away and making them aware of what's really at stake. Major League Baseball pulling out of Georgia, which makes absolutely no sense. Comparing Georgia voting laws to Jim Crow, which is just an absurdity. Right. So all of that, I think, is stacking up toward pushing toward 2022 being a good year for Republicans if we can just simply have some common sense about the way we go about our business.
Yeah, I think the goal is to win. Let's put our best candidate on the field in Georgia. I love Herschel Walker. He's a man of great faith. He's an entrepreneur, you know, a rock star in Georgia. Try to get more minorities running in the Republican Party. The African-American lady in Pennsylvania seems great. So my goal is to win. I'm going to meet President Trump this weekend. I'm playing golf with him tomorrow. He's the leader of the party. I want to come out with a kind of a contract with America agenda where we can unite the party around policy, you know, build a wall, you know, just the sanctity of life, things that bind Republicans together, and have a positive agenda for 2022. I'm bullish on 2022. The only way we can lose, I think, is just divide ourselves. And if we stay united, we're going to take back the House and the Senate.
Final question, because you've been very generous with your time with us today, and we always appreciate that. The border.
I love being on the show.
The border is a disaster. I think anybody that can see that. Now we've got the governor of Texas saying that they've got legitimate complaints at the facility in San Antonio of possibility of sexual abuse, malnutrition, and the spread of COVID. Is there anything that can be done to continue to put the spotlight and to try to fix this problem?
I think the spotlight will fix it. I've been there twice, Tony. You remember, I went down in February before it was cool, because I was told by Border Patrol agents during the holidays that the Biden administration is going to reverse all the Trump policies that worked, that the Remain in Mexico policy worked. People were coming here to file asylum claims. They really weren't asylum claims. They were just economic hardship claims. We would let them go in the United States. They'd be here in 5 years from now, and they would never show up. So what did Trump do? Said, you got to wait in Mexico to your hearing date, and the entire asylum system changed overnight. We sent all the unaccompanied minors back to their home, and their parents and others stopped paying for them to come to the United States. Both policies have been reversed. No longer do you have to wait in Mexico. You come here, apply for asylum, we let you go. It's called catch and release. Anybody under 16 stays in the United States. We had 172,000 people in March. In February, I showed you a hole in the wall where the gate was to be put up, and they never put it up. They had miles of wall with big holes in it. The gates to let water run through the wall were never put up, so people literally can walk through the wall or around the wall. I'm hearing now they're going to try to close some of these gaps. Until you change the policies and go back to what Trump did, we're going to be having close to 200,000 a month, 10% positive for COVID. I saw 600 people in a room built for 80. It's chaos. The Border Patrol agents and their families are national heroes. They're being overwhelmed. When we catch you at the border, if you're a young child, we will reunite you with your family members who are here illegally. We're encouraging more illegal immigration. It's $800 a day to take care of these kids for the American taxpayer. This journey from Central America through Mexico is dangerous for these young girls. It's just a nightmare, and I think it's going to be the biggest issue in 2022. And Biden needs to change policy. If he doesn't, we're going to have 2 million people at the end of the year come to our border.
Yes. Well, Senator, again, thank you for spending the time with us today. I always like to end our time by lifting you and your family up in prayer, so let's do that together. Father, I thank you for my brother. I thank you, God, that you've raised him up in a position of leadership for the day in which we live. I ask you to every day give him wisdom, protection, a special measure, Father God, of your grace to watch over him as he travels, as he listens, and as he makes decisions as a leader in our country at this critical time in our history. Watch over his family, care for them, and provide for his needs. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, thank you, Tony. That's a good way to start today, and we'll stay in touch. But this border is not a crisis. It's complete chaos, and it's heartbreaking, but it's dangerous. Terrorists are now finding a way to get into our country, people on the terrorist watch list. So I'll keep